My mom wears lipstick, eyeliner, mascara, blush, and eyebrow pencil to go to the dry cleaners. Dad is much as he always is, tall, spare, a quiet dresser, a wearer of hats. The difference is his face. He's deeply content. They touch each other often, hold hands, walk in unison. At the beach, the three of us wear matching sunglasses, and I have a ridiculous blue hat. We all lie in the sun, slathered in baby oil. We drink rum and coke and Hawaiian punch. My mother's star is rising. She studies with Jean Mech, with Mary Delacroix, and they carefully guide her along the paths of fame. She sings a number of small but gem-like roles, attracting the ears of Louis Bayard at the Lyric. She understudies Linnea Waverly's Aida. Then she is chosen to sing Carmen. Other companies take notice, and soon we are traveling around the world. She records Schubert for Decca, Verdi and Weill for EMI, and we go to London, to Paris, to Berlin, to New York. I remember only an endless series of hotel rooms and airplanes. Her performance at Lincoln Center is on television. I watch it with Graham and Gramps in Muncie. I am 6 years old, and I hardly believe that it's my mom, there in black and white on the small screen. She is singing Madame Butterfly. They make plans to move to Vienna after the end of the Lyric's 69-70 season. Dad auditions at the Philharmonic. Whenever the phone rings, it's Uncle Ish, Mom's manager, or someone from a record label. I hear the door at the top of the stairs open and clap shut, and then slowly descending footsteps. Claire knocks quietly 4 times, and I remove the straight-back chair from under the doorknob. There's still snow in her hair, and her cheeks are red. She is 17 years old. Claire throws her arms around me and hugs me excitedly.
"Merry Christmas, Henry," she says. "It's so great you're here."
I kiss her on the cheek. Her cheer and bustle have scattered my thoughts, but my sense of sadness and loss remains. I run my hands over her hair and come away with a small handful of snow that melts immediately.
"What's wrong?"
Claire takes in the untouched food, my uncheerful demeanor.
"You're sulking because there's no mayo?"
"Hey, hush." I sit down on the broken old lazy boy, and Claire squeezes in beside me. I put my arm around her shoulders. She puts her hand on my inner thigh. I remove it and hold it. Her hand is cold. "Have I ever told you about my mom?"
"No."
Claire is all ears. She's always eager for any bits of autobiography I let drop. As the dates on the list grow few and our 2 years of separation loom large, Claire is secretly convinced she can find me in real time if I would only dole out a few facts. Of course she can't, because I won't, and she doesn't. We each eat a cookie. Okay. Once upon a time, I had a mom. I had a dad, too, and they were very deeply in love, and they had me. And we were all pretty happy. And both of them were really terrific at their jobs, and my mother especially was great at what she did, and we used to travel all over seeing the hotel rooms of the world. So it was almost Christmas.
What year?
The year I was 6. It was the morning of Christmas Eve, and my dad was in Vienna because we were going to move there soon, and he was finding us an apartment. So the idea was that Dad would fly into the airport and Mom and I would drive out and pick him up, and we would all continue on to Grandma's house for the holidays. It was a gray, snowy morning, and the streets were covered in sheets of ice that hadn't been salted yet. Mom was a nervous driver. She hated expressways, hated driving to the airport, and had only agreed to do this because it made a lot of sense. We got up early and she packed the car. I was wearing a winter coat, a knit hat, boots, jeans, a pullover sweater, underwear, wool socks that were kind of tight, and mittens. She was dressed entirely in black, which was more unusual then than it is now. Claire drinks some of the milk directly from the carton. She leaves a cinnamon-colored lipstick print.
"What kind of car?"
"It was was a white 62 Ford Fairlane.
What's that?
Look it up. It was built like a tank. It had fins. My parents loved it. It had a lot of history for them. So we got in a car. I sat in the front passenger seat. We both wore our seatbelts, and we drove. The weather was absolutely awful. It was hard to see, and the defrost in that car wasn't the greatest. We went through this maze of residential streets, and then we got on the expressway. It was after rush hour, but traffic was a mess because of the weather and the holiday. So we were moving maybe 15-20 miles an hour. My mother stayed in the right-hand lane, probably because she didn't want to change lanes without being able to see very well, and because we weren't going to be on the expressway very long before we exited for the airport. We were behind a truck, well behind it, giving it plenty of room up there. As we passed an entrance, a small car, a red Corvette actually, got on behind us. The Corvette, which was being driven by a dentist who was only slightly inebriated, at 10:30 a.m., got on just a bit too quickly and was unable to slow down soon enough because of the ice on the road and hit our car. And in ordinary weather conditions, the Corvette would have been mangled and the indestructible Ford Fairlane would have had a bent fender and it wouldn't have been that big of a deal. But the weather was bad. The roads were slick. So the shove from the Corvette sent our car accelerating forward just as traffic slowed down. The truck ahead of us was barely moving. My mother was pumping the brakes, but nothing was happening. We hit the truck practically in slow motion, or so it seemed to me. In actuality, we were going about 40. The truck was an open pickup truck full of scrap metal. When we hit it, a large sheet of steel flew off the back of the truck, came through our windshield, and decapitated my mother. Claire has her eyes closed.
No.
It's true.
But you were right there. You were too short.
No, that wasn't it. The steel embedded in my seat right where my forehead should have been. I have a scar where it started to cut my forehead. I show Claire. It got my hat. The police couldn't figure it out. All my clothes were in the car, on the seat and the floor, and I was found stark naked by the side of the road.
You time traveled?
Yes, I time traveled. We are silent for a moment. It was only the second time it ever happened to me. I had no idea what was going on. I was watching us plow into this truck, and then I was in the hospital. In fact, I was pretty much unhurt, just in shock.
How? Why do you think it happened?
Stress. Pure fear. I think my body did the only trick it could. Claire turns her face to mine, sad and excited.
So,
Mom died. And I didn't. The front end of the Ford crumbled up. The steering column went through Mom's chest. Her head went through the now empty windshield and into the back of the truck. There was an unbelievable amount of blood. The guy in the Corvette was unscathed. The truck driver got out of his truck to see what hit him, saw Mom, fainted on the road, and was run over by a school bus driver who didn't see him and was gawking at the accident. The truck driver had two broken legs. Meanwhile, I was completely absent from the scene for 10 minutes and 47 seconds. I don't remember where I went. Maybe it was only a second or two for me. Traffic came to a complete halt. Ambulances were trying to come from 3 different directions and couldn't get near us for 30 minutes. Paramedics came running on foot. I appeared on the shoulder. The only person who saw me appear was a little girl. She was in the back seat of a green Chevrolet station wagon. Her mouth opened, and she just stared and stared.
But, Henry, you said you don't remember, and how could you know this anyway? 10 minutes and 47 seconds? Exactly?
I am quiet for a while, searching for the best way to explain. You know about gravity, right? The larger something is, the more mass it has, the more gravitational pull it exerts. It pulls smaller things to it, and they orbit around and around.
Yes?
My mother dying, it's the pivotal thing. Everything else goes around and around it. I dream about it, and I also time travel to it, over and over. If you could be there and you could hover over the scene of the accident, and you could see every detail of it, all the people, cars, trees, snowdrifts, if you had enough time to really look at everything, you would see me. I'm in cars, behind bushes, on the bridge, in a tree. I have seen it from every angle. I'm even a participant in the aftermath. I called the airport from a nearby gas station to page my father with the message to come immediately to the hospital. I sat in the hospital waiting room and watched my father walk through on his way to find me. He looks gray and ravaged. I walked along the shoulder of the road, waiting for my young self to appear, and I put a blanket around my thin child's shoulders. I looked into my small, uncomprehending face, and I thought. I am weeping now. Claire wraps her arms around me, and I cry soundlessly into her mohair-sweatered breasts.
What? What, Henry?
I thought. I should have died, too. We hold each other. I gradually get a hold of myself. I've made a mess of Claire's sweater. She goes to the laundry room and comes back wearing one of Alicia's white polyester chamber music playing shirts. Alicia's only 14, but she's already taller and bigger than Claire. I stare at Claire standing before me. I'm sorry to be here. Sorry to ruin her Christmas. I'm sorry, Claire.
I didn't mean to put all this sadness on you. I just find Christmas difficult. Oh, Henry, I'm so glad you're here, and, you know, I'd rather know. I mean, you just come out of nowhere and disappear, and if I know things about your life, you see more real, even terrible things. I need to know as much as you can say.
Alicia's calling down the stairs for Claire. It is time for Claire to join her family to celebrate Christmas. I stand, and we kiss cautiously. And Claire says, "Coming!" and gives me a smile, and then she's running up the stairs. I prop the chair under the door again and settle in for a long night. Christmas Eve, 2. Saturday, December 24th, 1988. Henry is 25. I call Dad and ask if he wants me to come over for dinner after the Christmas matinee concert. He makes a half-hearted attempt at inviting me, but I back out to his relief. The official DeTamble Day of Mourning will be conducted in multiple locations this year. Mrs. Kim has gone to Korea to visit her sisters. I've been watering her plants and taking in her mail. I call Ingrid Carmichael to ask her to come out with me, and she reminds me crisply that it's Christmas Eve and some people have families to kowtow to. I run through my address book. Everyone is out of town or in town with their visiting relatives. I should have gone to see Graham and Gramps. Then I remember they're in Florida. It's 2:53 in the afternoon and stores are closing down. I buy a bottle of schnapps at Al's and stow it in my overcoat pocket. Then I hop on the L at Belmont and ride downtown. It's a gray day and cold. The train is half full, mostly people with their kids going down to see Marshall Field's Christmas windows and do last-minute shopping at Water Tower Place. I get off at Randolph and walk east to Grant Park. I stand on the icy overpass for a while, drinking, and then I walk down to the skating rink. A few couples and little kids are skating. The kids chase each other and skate backward and do figure eights. I rent a pair of more or less my size skates, lace them on, and walk onto the ice. I skate the perimeter of the rink smoothly and without thinking too much. Repetition, movement, balance, cold air. It's nice. The sun is setting. I skate for an hour or so, then return the skates, pull on my boots, and walk. I walk west on Randolph and south on Michigan Avenue past the Art Institute. The lions are decked out in Christmas wreaths. I walk down Columbus Drive. Grant Park is empty except for the crows, which strut and circle over the evening blue snow. The streetlights tint the sky orange above me. It's a deep, cerulean blue over the lake. At Buckingham Fountain, I stand until the cold becomes unbearable, watching seagulls wheeling and diving, fighting over a loaf of bread somebody has left for them. A mounted policeman rides slowly around the fountain once and then sedately continues south. I walk. My boots are not quite waterproof, and despite my several sweaters, my overcoat is a bit thin for the dropping temperature. Not enough body fat. I'm always cold from November to April. I walk along Harrison over to State Street. I pass the Pacific Garden Mission, where the homeless have gathered for shelter and dinner. I wonder what they're having. I wonder if there's any festivity there in the shelter. There are a few cars. I don't have a watch, but I guess that it's about 7. I've noticed lately that my sense of time passing is different. It seems to run slower than other people's. An afternoon can be like a day to me. An L ride can be an epic journey. Today is interminable. I have managed to get through most of the day without thinking too much about Mom, about the accident, about all of it, but now, in the evening, walking, it is catching up with me. I realize I'm hungry. The alcohol has worn off. I'm almost at Adams, and I mentally review the amount of cash I have on me and decide to splurge on dinner at the Berghof, a venerable German restaurant famous for its brewery. The Berghof is warm and noisy. There are quite a few people eating and standing around. The legendary Berghof waiters are bustling importantly from kitchen to table. I stand in line, thawing out, amidst chattering families and couples. Eventually, I'm led to a small table in the main dining room toward the back. I order a dark beer and a plate of duckwursts with spätzle. When the food comes, I eat slowly. I polish off all the bread, too, and realize that I can't remember eating lunch. This is good. I'm taking care of myself. I'm not being an idiot. I'm remembering to eat dinner. I lean back in my chair and survey the room. Under the high ceilings, dark paneling, and murals of boats, middle-aged couples eat their dinners. They have spent the afternoon shopping or at the symphony, and they talk pleasantly of the presents they have bought, their grandchildren, plane tickets and arrival times, Mozart. I have an urge to go to the symphony now, but there's no evening program. Dad is probably on his way home from Orchestra Hall. I would sit in the upper reaches of the uppermost balcony, the best place to sit acoustically, and listen to Das Lied von der Erde, or Beethoven, or something similarly un-Christmassy. Oh well, maybe next year. I have a sudden glimpse of all the Christmases of my life lined up one after another, waiting to be gotten through, and despair floods me. No. I wish for a moment that time would lift me out of this day and into some more benign one. But then I feel guilty for wanting to avoid the sadness. Dead people need us to remember them, even if it eats us, even if all we can do is say, I'm sorry, until it is as meaningless as air. I don't want to burden this warm, festive restaurant with grief that I would have to recall the next time I'm here with Graham and Gramps, so I pay and leave. Back on the street, I stand pondering. I don't want to go home. I want to be with people. I want to be distracted. I suddenly think of the Get Me High Lounge, a place where anything can happen. A haven for eccentricity. Perfect. I walk over to Water Tower Place and catch the number 66 Chicago Avenue bus, get off at Damon, and take the number 50 bus north. The bus smells of vomit, and I'm the only passenger. The driver is singing Silent Night in a smooth church tenor, and I wish him a Merry Christmas as I step off the bus at Wabansia. As I walk past the fix-it shop, snow begins to fall, and I catch the big wet flakes on the tips of my fingers. I can hear music leaking out of the bar. The abandoned ghost train track looms over the street in the sodium vapor glare, and as I open the door, someone starts to blow a trumpet and hot jazz smacks me in the chest. I walk into it like a drowning man, which is what I have come here to be. There are about 10 people in the place, counting Mia, the bartender. 3 musicians, trumpet, standing bass, and clarinet, occupy the tiny stage, and the customers are all sitting at the bar. The musicians are playing furiously, swinging at maximum volume like sonic dervishes. And as I sit and listen, I make out the melody line of White Christmas. Mia comes over and stares at me, and I shout, "Whiskey and water!" at the top of my voice, and she bawls, "House!" And I yell, "Okay!" And she turns to mix it. There is an abrupt halt to the music. The phone rings, and Mia snatches it up and says, "Get me high!" She sets my drink in front of me, and I lay a 20 on the bar. "No," she says into the phone. "Well, dang! Well, fuck you, too!" She womps the receiver back into its cradle like she's dunking a basketball. Mia stands looking pissed off for a few moments, then lights a Pall Mall and blows a huge cloud of smoke at me. "Oh, sorry." The musicians troop over to the bar and she serves them beers. The restroom door is on the stage, so I take advantage of the break between sets to take a leak. When I get back to the bar, Mia has set another drink in front of my bar stool. "You're psychic," I say. "You're easy." She plunks her ashtray down and leans against the inside of the bar, pondering. "What are you doing later?" I review my options. I've been known to go home with Mia a time or two, and she's good fun and all that, but I'm really not in the mood for casual frivolity at the moment. On the other hand, a warm body is not a bad thing when you're down. "I'm planning to get extremely drunk. What did you have in mind?"
"Well, if you're not too drunk, you could come over. If you're not dead when you wake up, you could do me a huge favor and come to Christmas dinner at my parents' place in Glencoe and answer to the name of Rafe." "Oh, God, Mia. I'm suicidal just thinking about it. Sorry." She leans over the bar and speaks emphatically.
"Come on, Henry. Help me out. You're a presentable young person of the male gender. Hell, you're a librarian. You won't freak when my parents start asking who your parents are and what college you went to." "Actually, I will. I will run straight to the powder room and slit my throat. Anyway, what's the point? Even if they love me, it just means they'll torture you for years with whatever happened to that nice young librarian you were dating. And what happens when they meet the real Rafe?"
"I don't think I'll have that to worry about. Come on. I'll perform triple X sex acts on you that you've never even heard of."
I have been refusing to meet Ingrid's parents for months. I have refused to go to Christmas dinner at their house tomorrow. There is no way I'm going to do this for Mia, whom I hardly know. Mia, any other night of the year. Look, my goal tonight is to achieve a level of inebriation at which I can barely stand up, much less get it up. Just call your parents and tell them Rafe is having a tonsillectomy or something.
She goes to the other end of the bar to take care of three suspiciously young male college types. Then she messes around with bottles for a while, making something elaborate. She sets the tall glass in front of me. Here, it's on the house. The drink is the color of strawberry Kool-Aid. What is it? I take a sip. Tastes like 7-Up. Mia smiles an evil little smile. It's something I invented. You want to get smashed? This is the express train. Oh, well, thank you. I toast her and drink up. A sensation of heat and total well-being floods me. Heavens, Mia, you ought to patent this. You could have little lemonade stands all over Chicago and sell it in Dixie cups. You'd be a millionaire. Another? Sure. As a promising junior partner in De Tamble and De Tamil Alcoholics at Large, I have not yet found the outer limit in my ability to consume liquor. A few drinks later, Mia is peering at me across the bar with concern. Henry... Yeah, I'm cutting you off. This is probably a good idea. I try to nod my agreement with Mia, but it's too much effort. Instead, I slide slowly, almost gracefully, to the floor. I wake up much later at Mercy Hospital. Mia is sitting next to my bed. Her mascara has run all over her face. I am hooked up to an IV, and I feel bad, very bad. In fact, every kind of bad. I turn my head and retch into a basin. Mia reaches over and wipes my mouth. Henry, Mia is whispering.
Hey, what the hell?
Henry, I'm so sorry.
That's your fault.
What happened?
You passed out and I did the math. How much do you weigh?
175.
Jesus, did you eat dinner?
I think about it. Yeah? Well, anyway, the stuff you were drinking was about 40 proof. You had 2 whiskeys, but you seemed perfectly fine. And then all of a sudden you looked awful, and then you passed out... And I thought about it and realized that you had a lot of booze in you. So I called 911, and here you are.
Thanks,
I think.
Henry, do you have some kind of death wish?
I consider. Yes. I turn to the wall and pretend to sleep.
Saturday, April 8th, 1989. Claire is 17. Henry is 40. I'm sitting in Grandma Megrim's room, doing the New York Times crossword puzzle with her. It's a bright, cool April morning, and I can see red tulips whipping in the wind in the garden. Mama is down there planting something small and white over by the forsythia. Her hat is almost blowing off, and she keeps clapping her hand to her head and finally takes the hat off and sets her work basket on it. I haven't seen Henry in almost 2 months. The next date on the list is 3 weeks away. We are approaching the time when I won't see him for more than 2 years. I used to be so casual about Henry when I was little. Seeing Henry wasn't anything too unusual. But now every time he's here is one less time he's going to be here. And things are different with us. I want something. I want Henry to say something. Do something that proves this hasn't all been some kind of elaborate joke. I want. That's all. I am wanting. Grandma Megrim is sitting in her blue wing chair by the window. I sit in the window seat with the newspaper in my lap. We are about halfway through the crossword. My attention has drifted. Read that one again, child, says Grandma. 20 down, monkish monkey. 8 letters, second letter A, last letter N. Capuchin. She smiles. Her unseeing eyes turn in my direction. To Grandma, I am a dark shadow against a somewhat lighter background.
That's pretty good, huh?
Yeah, that's great. Geez, try this one. 19 across. Don't stick your elbow out so far. 10 letters, second letter U.
Burma shave. Before your time. Arr, I'll never get this.
I stand up and stretch. I desperately need to go for a walk. My grandmother's room is comforting but claustrophobic. The ceiling is low, the wallpaper is dainty blue flowers, the bedspread is blue chintz, the carpet is white, and it smells of powder and dentures and old skin. Grandma Megram sits trim and straight. Her hair is beautiful, white, but still slightly tinged with the red I have inherited from her, and perfectly coiled and pinned into a chignon. Grandma's eyes are like blue clouds. She has been blind for 9 years, and she has adapted well. As long as she is in the house, she can get around. She's been trying to teach me the art of crossword solving, but I have trouble caring enough to see one through by myself. Grandma used to do them in ink. Henry loves crossword puzzles. "It's a beautiful day, isn't it?" says Grandma, leaning back in her chair and rubbing her knuckles. I nod and then say, "Yes, but it's kind of windy. Mama's down there gardening, and everything keeps blowing away on her."
"How typical of Lucille," says her mother. "Do you know, child, I'd like to go for a walk."
"I was just thinking that same thing," I say. She smiles and holds out her hands, and I gently pull her out of her chair. I fetch our coats and tie a scarf around Grandma's hair to stop it from getting messed up by the wind. Then we make our way slowly down the stairs and out the front door. We stand on the drive, and I turn to Grandma and say, "Where do you want to go?"
"Let's go to the orchard," she says.
"That's pretty far." "Oh, Mama's waving. Wave back." We wave at Mama, who is all the way down by the fountain now. Peter, our gardener, is with her. He has stopped talking to her and is looking at us, waiting for us to go on so he and Mama can finish the argument they are having, probably about daffodils or peonies. Peter loves to argue with Mama, but she always gets her way in the end.
"It's almost a mile to the orchard, Grandma."
"Well, Claire, there's nothing wrong with my legs."
"Okay, then. We'll go to the orchard." I take her arm, and away we go. When we get to the edge of the meadow, I say, "Shade or sun?" And she answers,
"Oh, sun, to be sure."
And so we take the path that cuts through the middle of the meadow that leads to the clearing. As we walk, I describe. We're passing the bonfire pile. There's a bunch of birds in it.
Oh, there they go.
Crows, starlings,
doves, too, she says.
Yes, we're at the gate now. Watch out, the path is a little muddy. I can see dog tracks.
A pretty big dog, maybe Joey from Allingham's.
Everything is greening up pretty good. Here's that wild rose.
How high is the meadow? Asks Grandma.
Only about a foot. It's a real pale green. Here are the little oaks. She turns her face toward me, smiling.
Let's go and say hello.
I lead her to the oaks that grow just a few feet from the path. My grandfather planted these three oak trees in the 40s as a memorial to my great-uncle Teddy, Grandma's brother who was killed in the Second World War. The oak trees still aren't very big, only about 15 feet tall. Grandma puts her hand on the trunk of the middle one and says, "Hello." I don't know if she's addressing the tree or her brother. We walk on. As we walk over the rise, I see the meadow laid out before us, and Henry is standing in the clearing. I halt.
"What is it?"
Grandma asks. "Nothing," I tell her. I lead her along the path.
"What do you see?" she asks me.
"There's a hawk circling over the woods," I say.
"What time is it?"
I look at my watch. "Almost noon." We enter the clearing. Henry stands very still. He smiles at me. He looks tired. His hair is graying. He is wearing his black overcoat. He stands out dark against the bright meadow.
"Where is the rock?" Grandma says. "I want to sit down."
I guide her to the rock, help her to sit. She turns her face in Henry's direction and stiffens.
"Who's there?"
she asks me, urgency in her voice.
"No one," I lie.
"There's a man there," she says, nodding toward Henry.
He looks at me with an expression that seems to mean, "Go ahead, tell her." A dog is barking in the woods. I hesitate.
Claire,
Grandma says. She sounds scared.
Introduce us,
Henry says quietly. Grandma is still, waiting. I put my arm around her shoulders. It's okay, Grandma, I say. This is my friend Henry. He's the one I told you about. Henry walks over to us and holds out his hand. I place Grandma's hand in his. Elizabeth Megram, I say to Henry.
So you're the one,
Grandma says.
Yes,
Henry replies, and this yes falls into my ears like balm. Yes.
May I?
She gestures with her hands toward Henry.
Shall I sit next to you?
Henry sits on the rock. I guide Grandma's hand to his face. He watches my face as she touches his.
That tickles, Henry says to Grandma. Sandpaper, she says as she runs her fingertips across his unshaven chin. You're not a boy, she says.
No.
How old are you? I'm 8 years older than Claire.
She looks puzzled.
25?
I look at Henry's salt and pepper hair, at the creases around his eyes. He looks about 40, maybe older.
25, he says firmly.
Somewhere out there, it's true.
Claire tells me she's going to marry you,
my grandmother says to Henry. He smiles at me.
Yes, we're going to get married, in a few years when Claire is out of school. In my day, gentlemen came to dinner and met the family. Our situation is unorthodox. That hasn't been possible. I don't see why not. If you're going to cavort around in meadows with my granddaughter, you can certainly come up to the house and be inspected by her parents. I'd be delighted to,
Henry says, standing up.
But I'm afraid right now I have a train to catch. Just a moment, young man,
Grandma begins as Henry says, Goodbye, Mrs. Megram. It was great to finally meet you.
Claire, I'm sorry I can't stay longer.
I reach out to Henry, but there's the noise like all the sound is being sucked out of the world, and he's already gone. I turn to Grandma. She's sitting on the rock with her hands stretched out, an expression of utter bewilderment on her face.
What happened?
She asks me, and I begin to explain. When I am finished, she sits with her head bowed, twisting her arthritic fingers into strange shapes. Finally, she raises her face toward me.
But Claire, says my grandmother, he must be a demon.
She says it matter-of-factly, as though she's telling me that my coat's buttoned up wrong or that it's time for lunch.
What can I say?
I've thought of that, I tell her. I take her hands to stop her from rubbing them red. But Henry is good. He doesn't feel like a demon. Grandma smiles.
You talk as though you've met a peck of them.
Don't you think a real demon would be sort of demonic?
I think he would be nice as pie if he wanted to be.
I choose my words carefully. Henry told me once that his doctor thinks he's a new kind of human. You know, sort of the next step in evolution.
Grandma shakes her head. That is just as bad as being a demon. Goodness, Claire, why in the world would you want to marry such a person? Think of the children you would have, popping into next week and back before breakfast.
I laugh. But it will be exciting, like Mary Poppins or Peter Pan. She squeezes my hands just a little. Think for a minute, darling.
In fairy tales, it's always the children who have the fine adventures. The mothers have to stay at home and wait for the children to fly in the window.
I look at the pile of clothes lying crumpled on the ground where Henry has left them. I pick them up and fold them. Just a minute, I say, and I find the clothes box and put Henry's clothes in it. Let's go back to the house. It's past lunchtime. I help her off the rock. The wind is roaring in the grass, and we bend into it and make our way toward the house. When we come to the rise, I turn and look back over the clearing. It's empty. A few nights later, I am sitting by Grandma's bed, reading Mrs. Dalloway to her. It's evening. I look up. Grandma seems to be asleep. I stop reading and close the book. Her eyes open. Hello, I say.
Do you ever miss him?
She asks me. Every day. Every minute.
Every minute,
she says.
Yes. It's that way, isn't it? She turns on her side and burrows into the pillow. Good night, I say, turning out the lamp. As I stand in the dark, looking down at Grandma in her bed, self-pity floods me as though I have been injected with it. It's that way, isn't it? Isn't it?
Eat or be eaten. Saturday, November 30th, 1991. Henry is 28. Claire is 20. Claire has invited me to dinner at her apartment. Charisse, Claire's roommate, and Gomez, Charisse's boyfriend, will also be dining. At 6:59 p.m. Central Standard Time, I stand in my Sunday best in Claire's vestibule with my finger on her buzzer, fragrant yellow freesia and an Australian Cabernet in my other arm, and my heart in my mouth. I have not been to Claire's before, nor have I met any of her friends. I have no idea what to expect. The buzzer makes a horrible sound, and I open the door. All the way up, hollers a deep male voice. I plod up four flights of stairs. The person attached to the voice is tall and blonde, sports the world's most immaculate pompadour and a cigarette, and is wearing a Solidarnosc t-shirt. He seems familiar, but I can't place him. For a person named Gomez, he looks very Polish. I find out later that his real name is Jan Gomolinski. Welcome, library boy, Gomez booms. Comrade, I reply, and hand him the flowers and the wine. We eyeball each other, achieve detente, and with a flourish, Gomez ushers me into the apartment. It's one of those wonderful endless railroad apartments from the 20s, a long hallway with rooms attached almost as afterthoughts. There are two aesthetics at work here, funky and Victorian. This plays out in the spectacle of antique petit point chairs with heavy carved legs next to velvet Elvis paintings. I can hear Duke Ellington's I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good playing at the end of the hall, and Gomez leads me in that direction. Claire and Charisse are in the kitchen. My kittens, I have brought you a new toy, Gomez intones. It answers to the name of Henry, but you can call it Library Boy. I meet Claire's eyes. She shrugs her shoulders and holds her face out to be kissed. I oblige with a chaste peck and turn to shake hands with Charisse, who is short and round in a very pleasing way, all curves and long black hair. She has such a kind face that I have an urge to confide something, anything to her, just to see her reaction. She's a small Filipino Madonna. In a sweet, don't fuck with me voice, she says, Oh, Gomez, do shut up. Hello, Henry. I'm Charisse Bonavent. Please ignore Gomez. I just keep him around to lift heavy objects.
And sex. Don't forget the sex, Gomez reminds her.
He looks at me.
Beer?
Sure. He delves into the fridge and hands me a Blatz. I pry off the cap and take a long pull. The kitchen looks as though a Pillsbury dough factory has exploded in it. Claire sees the direction of my gaze. I suddenly recollect that she doesn't know how to cook. It's a work in progress, says Claire.
It's an installation piece, says Charisse.
Are we gonna eat it? Asks Gomez.
I look from one to the other, and we all burst out laughing.
Do any of you know how to cook?
No.
Gomez can make rice.
Only rice-a-roni.
Claire knows how to order pizza.
And Thai. I can order Thai, too.
Charisse knows how to eat.
Shut up, Gomez, say Charisse and Claire in unison. Well, what was that gonna be? I inquire, nodding at the disaster on the counter. Claire hands me a magazine clipping. It's a recipe for chicken and shiitake risotto with winter squash and pine nut dressing. It's from Gourmand, and there are about 20 ingredients.
Do you have all this stuff?
Claire nods. The shopping part I can do. It's the assembly that perplexes. I examine the chaos more closely. I could make something out of this.
You can cook?
I nod.
It cooks! Dinner is saved! Have another beer! Gomez exclaims. Charisse looks relieved and smiles warmly at me. Claire, who has been hanging back almost fearfully, sidles over to me and whispers, "You're not mad?" I kiss her just a tad longer than is really polite in front of other people. I straighten up, take off my jacket, and roll up my sleeves. "Give me an apron," I demand. "You, Gomez, open that wine. Claire, clean up all that spilled stuff. It's turning to cement. Charisse, would you set the table?" 1 hour and 43 minutes later, we are sitting around the dining room table eating chicken risotto stew with pureed squash. Everything has lots of butter in it. We are all drunk as skunks.
The whole time Henry is making dinner, Gomez is standing around the kitchen making jokes and smoking and drinking beer, and whenever no one is looking, he makes awful faces at me. Finally, Charisse catches him and draws her finger across her throat and he stops. We are talking about the most banal stuff, our jobs and school and where we grew up and all the usual things that people talk about when they meet each other for the first time. Gomez tells Henry about his job being a lawyer, representing abused and neglected children who are wards of the state. Charisse regales us with tales of her ex